Natasha Mitchell with you for All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. Hello to you. Where I live is very urban, not so much suburban, but definitely burdened with bitumen. At times I ache for green acres. And that pull could well be in my genes, and yours too. The acclaimed Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson has suggested we're entering an eremozoic age, the age of loneliness, isolated from all other living organisms. He popularised what's called the biophilia hypothesis, the idea that we're biologically drawn to natural landscapes. It's a scientifically woolly but compelling possibility. Intuitively, we sense that grass, trees and water relax us, but finding solid empirical evidence for a relationship between ecology and our state of mind has been more difficult. Well, environmental psychologists are now onto it. Crime rates, academic performance, aggression, your mental health, even attention deficit disorder. Could a bit of urban greeting make all the difference?
This idea that we are part of the environment, in fact all our genes derive from exactly the same molecules as the rest of the universe. We're made of the same stuff as the rest of the universe. Therefore, it seems appropriate that we yearn to have some close relationship with eco, and eco in Greek means home, habitat. You know, as one of the eco-psychologists rightly said, if we want to deny our relationship with nature, then what we should do is try not to breathe for 10 minutes and see what happens.
You know, it's sort of like chocolate. You can find the odd person who doesn't like it. Turns out that if you look at research from around the world, there's a pretty universal preference for green places and places that involve nature, places that include water. There's actually an evolutionary argument for that, and it's been studied in various non-human species. And it makes a lot of sense, right? If you think about a bird who tends to thrive in certain environments, if that bird doesn't tend to want to spend time in those environments and instead flies off to places where the bugs it eats don't live and it's easily visible to predators, well, that bird is not going to do as well and leave as many offspring. And so organisms should naturally select to love the places that they thrive in.
Indeed, and Wilson talks about how our brain did not evolve and grow and adapt within an environment that was full of grey filing cabinets. It was actually within a more savanna-like landscape where there were grassy open plains and dotted trees around, which is much more congruent with what our park-like settings are in today's world.
Hi, my name's Nancy Layette. I'm an artist at the St. Kilda Bowling Club Studios, and I'm lucky enough that these studios are surrounded by a massive community garden. And so every day coming to my studios, I walk through the gardens. If I feel a block, I go walk in the gardens for creative inspiration. I think we all joke here, it's just a matter of time before we start painting vegetables and flowers. It's just
the aubergine series.
you can't help but be influenced by it. It's an extremely pleasant environment to create within.
Well, interesting you say that it sort of unleashes some of your creative blockages. Tell me a little bit more about that. What is it about a green space that might foster that?
Walking through, looking at nature, there's a certain randomness to it, but there's also, at least for me, it's the sense of order that comes with it, that as an artist and in some of the work that I do, I could sit and stare at a plant up close for an hour and just meditate on what's happening within that. And the longer you stare at it, the more you start to see. And it just, it opens your mind to being able to do that on a larger scale with other everyday objects.
Fascinating. So in a way, it's sort of freeing up your mind, but focusing it in a different way, it seems.
Absolutely.
You're a lucky one. Thank you very much. Good luck with the artwork.
Thanks very much. Have a great day.
An artist in residence at the studios of the Veg Out Community Garden in Melbourne's St Kilda, right next to Luna Park. Check out the spectacle on our website. So today we're greening the mind. What do encounters with nature in urban settings do to the state of your psyche? Coming up, a therapist who uses nature as a metaphoric tool with her clients. But first, environmental psychologist Professor Francis Kuo directs the Landscape and Human Health Lab at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, doing cutting-edge work in urban settings.
For years, we've had these intuitions, and Thoreau and various people have written about how nature has this healing power. But there wasn't really much in the way of any kind of scientific evidence. And so policymakers have treated green space and green elements in the urban environment as an amenity. Nice if you can afford it. But if you can't afford it, there's no real harm in having a city that has no vegetation, has no contact with nature. And as we've been studying it, it's been really very exciting the last few years. There's just incredible evidence rolling in that nature really does seem to play a role in human health in every imaginable way.
One of your earlier studies looked at the relationship between vegetation and crime in urban environments. It's a very interesting relationship, counterintuitive potentially.
That's true. Most people, when you ask about how vegetation might impact crime, they say, well, people can hide in the bushes and leap out at you. In fact, there's good basis for that. But it turns out that if you look at vegetation, trees and grass and landscapes that preserve visibility, that kind of landscape actually encourages people, at least in residential areas, to use the spaces outside their homes more. And that provides a natural form of surveillance. And in fact, the data seem to indicate that if you have a landscape where you've introduced well-maintained trees and grass, people will tend to find that a safer environment than without.
Take us to the public housing development in Chicago that you have done a lot of work with. An earlier study came up with some surprising results here.
We did about 10 years worth of work in Chicago public housing. So that's inner city Chicago, some of the poorest neighborhoods in the United States. Single women with three kids, roughly, and they're really struggling to make ends meet. They don't have much in the way of social support. Very few of them have phones. The public transportation in the area is pretty limited. Their whole world are these sort of very crowded, small apartments. And then the kids don't have much opportunity to play outside in many cases because it's fairly violent and dangerous. And so we looked at 2 years of police crime data for roughly 200 apartment buildings. And we compared apartment buildings that were smaller and larger and had more and fewer trees around them. And it turns out that the relationship between crime and vegetation is very clear, very systematic, quite the opposite of what people might think. The more trees, the fewer crimes.
This is a really tricky one, isn't there? Because there are a stack of other factors that affect crime. So you've got socioeconomic variables, education, population density, all that. Did you take into account all those other factors?
The nice thing about Chicago public housing in that regard, the population is fairly consistent. So everyone who's there is below a very low income threshold. So the socioeconomic factors are fairly constant. And then the other thing that's useful scientifically about the setting is that the buildings tend to be identical and they vary only in the amount of vegetation that's immediately around them.
So you suggest you could control for lots of other factors just by the very nature of the development. So to give us a sense of the magnitude of the impact that it seems vegetation had on crime statistics in the police records.
If you take into account building size, the number of people in each building, and all the possible sort of environmental and social variables we could track, you get roughly 7% of the differences between buildings being explained by vegetation. It's not doubling or having the amount of crime, but it's clearly an amount that's worth paying attention to. I think most mayors, if they came in and managed to reduce crime by 7%, they would be pretty happy about it.
On what basis do you believe that vegetation mitigates some of the psychological precursors to violence, you know, to aggression in that sort of context?
The argument comes from sort of a number of different studies. Nature calms people and it also helps them psychologically rejuvenate. When people are psychologically rejuvenated, they're better able to handle challenges which come their way. So, for instance, if someone says something rude to you, you might have an impulse to do something similarly rude in return, but if you're in relatively good shape, then you manage to inhibit that impulse. And so we actually have evidence showing where you can take people and expose them to more or less nature, and they actually perform better or worse on tests of impulse control.
I can imagine, though, that people would say, oh, right, planting trees. What about the intense poverty? What about, you know, gun control? What about all these other issues that seem to be fundamental to criminal behaviour? Isn't planting a bunch of trees a sort of benign option?
I think certainly we want to address the causes or the sort of root causes of crime, but to the extent that we haven't managed to do those and it doesn't cost very much at all compared to social programs to plant a few trees around an apartment building, I think we should use whatever tools we have at our disposal.
Well, interestingly, the Chicago Public Housing Authority have apparently taken this up with a gusto.
They've been greening like mad.
Have they really?
Yes, it's really kind of exciting. A number of developments have really transformed from barren concrete jungle that you imagine to places with trees and grass and playground equipment. They've really decided that instead of treating the outdoors as sort of negative space, the leftover space between buildings, that these spaces are important. They serve as sort of community living rooms.
And Francis Kuo's team are studying children with ADHD now too. More on that in a moment. We're greening the mind on All in the Mind. Natasha Mitchell with you on ABC Radio National and online as a podcast, as a blog, a whole lot more on Radio Australia as well.
Well, back here is tomatoes, and I've tried to stake them up on those tall stakes, but they're growing so fast they've sort of got a bit out of control. In front of that I've got two eggplants. And the tomato that's out in the front, it's a... my name's Kathy, and I've been gardening here for nearly 2 years now. To me, it's just as much about community as gardening.
What does it mean to you to get your hands in earth, in soil? What does it do to your state of mind is what I'm really interested in.
I think it's very calming. Somehow getting dirty hands in something that's as nice as soil, there's some sort of satisfaction of being, well, really in a way, primitive, connection with nature... being out in the open air, a bit of space. I like to take my time when I'm gardening and enjoy it.
People also get very artistic with their gardens, don't they? This used to be an old bowling club, so there is actually a garden just over there that is like a memorial to old bowlers.
Yeah, somebody's put up a sign there that says something like, old bowlers don't die, they just turn into compost.
Fantastic. UK-based Amber Burles is a self-described ecotherapist. She uses natural environments as a setting for her work with people with a range of disabilities. Nature is her co-therapist in effect. She was a community mental health nurse for 20 years, but she's now calling for a greening of public health. I had an interesting and very palpable feeling recently when I was walking through a forest. And I had this strong sense that of feeling very surreal that this was in fact a film set, because I spend so much time in an urban context these days. I mean, you know something's really wrong when you think the forest is the film set and the urban space is reality.
It was very interesting because the first steps of an ecotherapeutic process is actually about that very process. It's about putting a person in a very urban, sterile, noisy, unhealthy, too heavy on stimulus environment, and then taking them through to an outdoor space, often a garden or a wild area or something where the sound completely changes, the feeling around where you are completely changes, and you immediately have a sense of peace.
Amber Burles' PhD has been developing a framework for ecotherapy with a wildlife haven in a large community park in the thick of West London called Meanwhile Gardens. In a project for people whose lives have been fractured by mental health problems, it's become an oasis for recovery as they train to become horticulturalist gardeners. And for protected species like the crested newt too. Amber's technique uses potent metaphors from nature as she gardens with her clients. She says nurturing nature gives them something that humanity can't, helping them feel part of a bigger whole, as she puts it, and creating public green spaces while they're at it.
One lady came about one day and actually, in a obviously fit of anger, uprooted this shrub from the ground and cried, obviously, alongside it. And the therapist in the garden took her to one side and asked her what this was about. And it turns out that she felt just like that bush. She felt uprooted and she was very angry because of it. And what they did together in a short space of time is to replant that shrub, not with any guarantee that it would survive. So that metaphor was important because they were now trying to nurture this plant back to some kind of health, as they might be nurturing her, or she might nurture herself back. Didn't need any language, didn't need any translation. It was obvious. One particular client, we needed to weed this specific space. The one thing that this person kept doing was to take each weed out individually and put them on a little pile. And when I asked, why are you doing that? That is a pile of all the people that I find difficult to deal with in my life. Mm. So I said, well, what are you going to do with it? He says, I haven't decided yet, but I will deal with it. At the moment, all I'm doing is putting them where I know where they are, and I know they're safe there, and they won't come to upset me.
Are you guiding them? Are you giving them those leading metaphors? Or, I mean, what's the therapeutic framework for you as a practitioner?
For me, I think the important thing for an ecotherapist is to remain eclectic in terms of models. So that if you have a number of models in your therapeutic toolbox, you have to be an opportunist. So that when something develops right in front of you that nature has provided you with, or that the person has provided you working with nature, that you seize the moment immediately. That means you've got to know the client, you've got to know the history, you've got to know them quite well. That is really what I want to train people to become, this opportunist conduit to metaphorical meanings, which then develop into therapy.
You know, psychiatrists and other psychologists could just say, here's a hippie who's also a therapist, and they're weaving their hippiedom into their therapy work.
Well, I've had that thrown at me lots of times, and the New Age label comes to mind as well. And I would just like anyone who wants to give that label to come to meanwhile and spend, you know, a couple of days there and speak to the people, talk to the public who comes through, just see it for themselves.
Eco-gardener and eco-therapist Ambra Burls. Some have argued we're experiencing an epidemic of what's been dubbed nature deficit disorder, especially children. Environmental psychologist Professor Francis Kuo, with colleagues, is finding that green spaces have a real impact on attention and impulse control in young people, which got them researching a possible nature therapy for children with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. In a survey, parents consistently reported that ADHD symptoms were improved after activities in greener settings as opposed to indoor or built environments. But can science really rely on parental bias about a child's behaviour?
We've been trying to get at that in a more recent study where we've taken children on walks through different settings, and then we've actually done performance tests on their attention afterwards with someone who doesn't know which walk they went on, whether they went on a green walk or a less green walk or a very green walk.
Have you got any results yet?
They look very encouraging.
Let's come to a possible mechanism here, because you and others in the field of environmental psychology have done some really interesting thinking about attention and nature, and you distinguish between what you call directed attention and undirected or involuntary attention. Tell me about that distinction.
Right. The best way to explain it probably is to think about paying attention. So there are times where you're engaged and focused and it's effortful. You have to actually be active about it, driving through heavy traffic or listening to an incredibly boring conversation. On the other hand, there are other kinds of stimuli that are just very easy to attend. In fact, it's almost difficult to tear yourself away. Babies draw attention in nature and animals, fires, anything sort of very emotional in content draws our attention. That's what we are referring to when we refer to involuntary attention. And so these different modes of attention operate in very different ways. What we're learning is that paying attention actually does, in a sense, involve paying.
You talk about the concept of mental fatigue and this directed attention really elevates our mental fatigue. So what measurements or observations have been made about what nature does to our attention?
Something more like 15 or 16 systematic studies now where they've tested the effects of some form of nature exposure or another on attention. And what we generally find is that nature helps people recover from attention fatigue.
You know, nature's many things, and do you distinguish between scales of nature, sort of a dose response, if you like, if we think of it in medical terms? So, you know, the impact of a pocket of grass in between two high-rises, does that have the same impact as a whole urban forest or community garden over an acre?
Well, that's a great question. We don't have a great deal of data on this question, but what we have says that every bit helps. So if you have nothing, then even a scrubby tree and a little bit of grass are demonstrably better.
Because parents are in a desperate situation. Parents at their end of the tether are giving their children Ritalin. They're reaching out for many solutions. So
that's right.
It's a very delicate thing to come up with an alternative therapy for children, isn't it, and tout its benefits.
This is one area where I feel fairly confident. There's not really much in the way of a downside. Well, they might get some exercise and get some fresh air. I think I'm probably more confident or more willing to suggest trying it than somebody who had a new drug.
I wonder how you can strip out that it's actually green spaces that make the difference. I know that you compared green outdoor spaces to more urban outdoor spaces, but I mean, could it be the fact that they're just outside burning off some of the hyperactive impulses that they embody?
Right, that's a great question. The way we tried to get at that was we would compare, first of all, we would look at activities such as reading. And it turns out that reading in a green outdoor area or with a green view seems to be more helpful than reading in a basement or reading indoors. Mm. So even when you're comparing relatively sedentary activities, you see the environmental effect. Active activities such as basketball also show a green effect. Even when you sort of look at activities which are equally active or passive, you still see the green effect.
Professor Francis Kuo from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And what's your name?
Arabelle.
And what do you like about the community garden?
The sandpit. Climb up the trees.
Climb up the trees.
I really enjoy my daughter coming down here. She's 9 years old now. She actually has her own plot. She's the youngest gardener here. She can spend hours here meeting other children, playing with the rabbits, the guinea pigs. She feeds all our scraps to the chooks and makes the compost and just fiddling around, doing the sort of things that children do when they've got access to open space.
Of course, most urban children don't have the luxury of a community garden like St Kilda's Veg Out. Kathleen Baggett, a PhD candidate at Monash University, has been investigating the cognitive impact of the amount of greenery in 14 primary school playgrounds, which is where most kids encounter a bit of nature.
One school had less than 100 cubic metres of vegetation, which would be, if you can imagine a cubic metre of vegetation, that one of the schools had less than 100, whereas another school had over 14,000. So within a very small sample of 14 schools, there's considerable difference.
Now, you put these kids to work before and after they spent time in these playgrounds. What did you get them to do?
What I was measuring was their capacity to direct attention or to remain focused. And so a series of different tests were used both before and after play, the same tests were used. They were asked to search for specific letters within a page full of multiple letters, look for specific numbers within multiple numbers, having to translate a code into different numbers that was provided, and to do almost like a dot-to-dot, but changing from alphabetical to numerical, so they had to do the dot to dot in order from A1 to through to B2 all the way through. So that allowed me, because they had to maintain focus, had to ignore distractions, and had to be able to continue the work within a confined time period, gave me an indication as to how focused can they be within these periods of times before playtime, after they'd done a few more, a couple of hours of morning classes, and then whether that was able to change after their play period.
You got them to keep diaries as well.
You know, just a one or two word, you know, they played basketball or they were sat and talked, just a few little excerpts for what they did, who they did it with, whether they did it alone, with just a couple of other children or with three or more children, and then whether they enjoyed their play period experience or not.
So you're still crunching the data rather heavily, but you did want to strip out whether the nature and volume of vegetation had an impact on their attention. And have you managed to do that?
I have. It didn't directly change their attention scores per se, but what it did do was the amount of vegetation within their school playground really affected how restorative they felt their playground was. And if they felt that their school playground was a restorative environment, then that actually then translated into increases in their attention scores after playtime.
Attention is affected by many different things. It might be affected by the child's individual psychology, whether they had a good breakfast that morning, whether they had a good lunch, all that sort of stuff has a palpable impact on a child's academic performance.
What I did was they acted as their own control. So whether those who didn't have breakfast or did have breakfast, it was all accounted for within that design.
So their intention improves. The challenge then is, how does that actually translate to academic performance?
I'm really into social application of research, and I'm really into being able to answer that so what factor. And so for children who are scoring higher on those attention measures, score higher on standardised academic performance tests in both maths and English. So those attention scores translate into academic achievement, period.
Bingo. So what would be the implications of your work, do you think? People talk about the concept of a hidden curriculum. Is this part of that?
Yes, it is. It falls exactly under that banner, where I'm hoping that once the numbers have all completely crunched and the results all unfold as currently appear to be doing so, is that school administrations and education departments will be looking at their school playgrounds as an extension of the school in terms of an academic place, which is happening in research around the world with learning through landscapes and learning outdoor classrooms, and therefore in turn would be able to look at design aspects of school playgrounds by incorporating different vegetation sources such as trees and grassy spaces, but also gardens and flower gardens, vegetable gardens, native gardens, things like that.
Kathleen Baggett from Monash University's School of Psychology, Psychiatry and Psychological Medicine, taking to the playground. More info, audio and my gossipy sort of blog as well on All in the Mind's website at abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. And a note to catch the Sideshow series on biodiversity, balancing nature, the last episode on Monday night at 7 p.m. or online. Thanks to producer Anita Barrow and to sound engineer Chris Lawson. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Until next week, look after your head. And last words go to Amber Burles on the therapeutic potential of nature.
We discovered a piece of tree trunk. It was obvious that it had been cut a long time ago on both sides. But in the middle of this piece of trunk was a little tiny branch with bright green shoots, leaves. It was so telling that even something that could appear to be dead still has within it enough energy to spring alive again. That is a metaphor for people, that we can still grow in spite of whatever life throws at us. There's no therapist that could put words to that. It's just so visible, so clearly visible to anybody. And that source of meaning is your own personal source of meaning. The value of something that you've grown inside yourself, that you've developed yourself, and that you can relate to without having to go to someone else to find it, makes for what I call sustainable therapy, which I think ecotherapy is.